for the 11 years that I've been here, you know, feed additives has remained fairly consistent. You know, like I said, that 25-35% of what we're doing here, and that excludes enzymes. So when I talk about that, you know, I kind of put enzymes into their own category. So that's excluding that. So that's your probiotics, prebiotics, you know, essential oils, organic acids, and then basically you come some of your phyto products, as I guess you would say. And that's kind of been some of the biggest trends I've seen in the last 4 or 5 years, especially.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Nexus, powered by SAM, where science meets performance. To give your birds optimal gut health and performance, trust Poultry Star from DSM Firmenich, the ideal blend of probiotics and prebiotics for your flock. AB Vista, intelligent nutritional solutions to boost poultry health and performance. Natural Biologics is looking deeper to find the natural solutions to your poultry health challenges. Sid Lines, an eco lab company, AV Prime program offers a broad range of cleaning and disinfection solutions combined with tailored advice to improve hygiene on your farm or hatchery.
Welcome to the Poultry Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. I'm Doug Corver, dedicated to bringing you the latest insights and discussions in the poultry industry. Get ready to expand your knowledge and stay ahead with today's episode. If you find this interview interesting, please let us know by visiting our website at wisenetics.com. Our guest today is Dr. Dan Moore, who is president at Colorado Quality Research. Welcome to the program, Dan.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background and your path to where you are now?
Yeah, certainly. So I grew up in an agricultural family. My dad's a veterinarian in northern Missouri. So that always has, you know, began everything for me. In elementary school, we were hatching eggs and doing things like that, looking at the development of birds and embryos. So that really got my interest going into poultry. And then I raised poultry on the farm there and took them to the local fair. And so I just continued to develop that. Really started with ducks, but ducks are limited as far as where you can go with poultry. They're out there, but that was limited. So I went to the University of Missouri and got my bachelor's in animal science there. And during that process, I really learned more about nutrition, what you could do in poultry, what you could do in animal sciences in general. And that led me down the path to go into poultry nutrition, where I got my master's at the University of Missouri there, looking at the sulfur amino acid requirements in turkeys. Then my thought process was maybe I should, you know, go somewhere new, try something a little bit different. So I went to North Carolina State University to get my PhD once again in nutrition. But then I did a minor in biotechnology there as well, because that was something that was developing. That was, you know, not 2000 to 2004 range. And, you know, biotechnology is really picking up and starting to kick off. So I got into that as in turkeys once again, did that. And then during that time frame there, I learned a little bit more about some of the biotechnology techniques that were there. NC State was pretty big at that at the time and still is. So then I decided to do a postdoc at the USDA, actually out here in Fort Collins in 2005 and 2006, looking at primordial germ cell cryopreservation at the time. And so I did a project there I started working with to kind of develop more of my lab techniques and that sort of thing. Then I switched gears again and went back into the industry and focused more on nutrition and had some technical service and research management roles from there. And then I came out here in 2014, so I've been out here a little over 11 years, had the opportunity to buy into the company, and so something I did, and so me and my business partners are the third owners of Colorado Quality Research.
At Nexus, powered by SAM, we redefine livestock nutrition with science-backed innovations that enhance performance, maximize efficiency, and promote sustainability. We connect producers with the future of animal health and productivity through cutting-edge feed technologies and environmentally conscious solutions. By addressing the demand for efficient, sustainable nutrition, we reflect SAM Nutrition's commitment to excellence, delivering premium, scientifically proven solutions that drive results.
Can you tell us a little bit about your company?
Yeah, certainly. So it's a private, you know, contract research organization, as they call them. It's been around since 1983. It was started by Dr. Kerry Quarles. The reason it's in Colorado is because there used to be a turkey presence along the Front Range out here. And Dr. Quarles was a professor at Colorado State University. And so that combination, he'd had poultry background. There's still some guys out there in the industry that worked underneath him. Maybe even got their master's here at Colorado State and then moved on. And so he started this facility in 1983, and it's just kind of expanded a little bit over time throughout the history of the company. You know, to start out with one or two buildings, and now we're up to over eight buildings. We can do 13 to 15 studies at a time. We have two locations, our primary location, and then we lease another facility, actually that Kerry Quarles started prior to this, to do some spillover work or some disease challenge stuff that we may not want on the main facility. And in the early 2000s, Dr. Steve Davis took the facility over, and they started developing their feed mill. So now we have our own feed mill on site to manufacture all of our own feed and that sort of thing. So it's taken kind of an interesting turn here or there. Steve was a veterinarian. I'm a nutritionist. And so we've going back and forth and oscillated. So we have several disease challenge models just from the history of the company and how we continue to do it. And now, you know, over the course of time that I've been here for about 11 years, we've kept that piece of it, but also added some more nutritional pieces to it. So we're doing a fair amount of nutritional work at this time as well.
So as a contract research organization, what are the trends that you're seeing related to feed additives over the years?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. As a CRO, obviously, we're a little bit different than a university system. We're doing a lot more comparison type work, that sort of thing. So people come to us looking for different things than they would if they were going to a university typically. So, you know, we do something different from that standpoint. You know, our charge is a little bit different. You know, we're not necessarily worried about publications and that sort of thing. So, people come to us with comparisons, maybe some early on developmental work that they don't necessarily want published. And so, from a feed additive standpoint, we're running anywhere from, 50 to 60 studies a year here. And the feed additive portion makes up about 30% of that. That could be just performance based. It could be challenge based, some kind of stress or some kind of environmental stress, disease challenge, any number of things like that. And people have been talking about feed additives for quite some time, obviously. We've gone back and forth with the antibiotic free situations. And so they've been popular for quite some time. I would say for the 11 years that I've been here, feed additives has remained fairly consistent. Like I said, that 25% to 35% of what we're doing here. And that excludes enzymes. So when I talk about that, I kind of put enzymes into their own category. So that's excluding that. So that's your probiotics, prebiotics, essential oils, organic acids, and then basically you come some of your phyto products, as I guess you would say. And that's kind of been some of the biggest trends I've seen in the last 4 or 5 years, especially. When you look at our feed additive category, most of the time, 45-50% of that's been what you would call the DFM category. The phyto products that I would call it, they have gone from about 10% of our feed additive category to over 20, approaching 30% at times. And that's kind of the cost of some of the smaller feed additives, some acidifiers and some different things like that that come up. And we do one or two studies a year on that. But the phyto products have really, really taken off in the last, the last several years. And in that category, there's different groups of that. And one thing we've been looking at here recently a little bit, and like I said, this isn't necessarily something that we are going out and recruiting. It's what's coming to us, so I feel it's kind of a trend of what we're seeing, whether, we work with integrators and they're looking at that, or they're sending someone to us, or someone's trying to get into the integrators and trying to better understand their product. So I feel like we're kind of seeing what that category is doing and what that movement is. And, one area really is some of the polyphenol work is showing up more and more, you know, as we go into that phytobiotic category.
So is the context then primarily in antibiotic alternatives with the work that you're doing?
It is in that context, but it's also in replacement of some other standard additives, you know. So obviously cost is a huge concern when we're looking at any kind of additive or any type of ingredient. So it's looking at a variety of different things. Initially really started out as the antibiotic alternative. So I think that really got things going and things moving forward. But what's now changing as we're going away from if it's an antibiotic free or antibiotic alternative is now how does it really react in the system with other environmental stresses, or can you replace something in the diet? Can you make the diet a little bit cheaper? Can you improve performance and those types of things? So that's really what it's, what's been going on there.
So looking specifically at the phytogenic products, what are some of the changes you've seen in the last 11 years at CQR related to the phytogenics?
It's been interesting, right? You know, so I guess I might have been a little skeptical in the beginning with some of the phytogenics. But if you look at human medicine and human supplementation, it makes sense. You know, there are several human medicines out there that are plant-based, plant-derived, you know, so it makes sense that there's going to be some efficacy with that. When I first started, I would say a lot of it, we were testing a lot of byproducts. We were not testing specific products, or they weren't looking at specific analytes or metabolites per se. And also with that, you know, there's a production system that goes in place. And so I would say the production wasn't very consistent when I first started here. You're consistent on how they manufacture, right? Because you're starting up small scale, venture laptop, and then you're trying to grow that up into a larger scale where you can actually manufacture product that goes into the industry. So several times I was seeing some very promising initial results, and then they would try to ramp up for manufacturing and efficacy would go away. And I'd be like, I would try to help them out or look at it like, hey, man, this looks really nice. And then the next time it's like, I didn't see anything, you know, what's going on? Like, well, we changed this part of the process in order to get higher volume. And it's like, well, something happened there that took away from the efficacy. So they become more focused on production as far as, you know, how do we produce it? How do we ramp it up? Testing from that standpoint, for metabolites in there, can we test it? Can we get something that's a little bit more standard, a little bit more efficacious, and then we can keep that as we go through that process. They've also done a much better job, I think, in discovery work, you know, instead of just saying, hey, it's a byproduct of this. What do we really need to look at? You know, is it a byproduct that we can standardize, or do we need to go out and look directly just to create these products? Versus trying to pull something off of a waste stream of some other type of industry. So it's changed quite a little bit from that standpoint. So I'm getting more standard products. I'm getting more products that are consistent. Consistency is a big issue, or I would say used to be a big issue. It's something they've worked a lot on in the past 10 or 11 years that I see that's really coming into play, and they're doing a much better job with it.
Yeah, and I think that's a frustration that a lot of researchers have, where there's promising results at the small scale and not always seen in commercial applications. So, it's great to hear the advances in the development of new products. So let's talk about polyphenols specifically. What are you seeing in terms of trends with polyphenols as additives?
What makes sense with polyphenols, obviously, is from an antioxidant perspective. And so that's really where they're starting to focus on. And that's not a new concept. I mean, when I was back in graduate school with selenium and everything else, you know, that was big in the early 2000s, late 90s, you know. So we went through a lot of antioxidant research back then, you know, reactive oxygen speciation and that sort of thing. So it's along those same lines. Once again, we're looking from an antioxidant perspective. How do you replace or help or assist or in combination with other types of antioxidants? That's really where they've been looking at. And once again, I think it's a production standpoint. I mean, I remember hearing about polyphenols probably the first time 2005 or 2006. It's like, okay, well, you're going to have to drink, you know, 15 bottles of wine a day or something like that to get the value you need. And they've done a good job in concentrating that and trying to find the correct combinations or correct combination from different products to do that. So that's really what I've seen. I've seen that kind of shift from, once again, just kind of that generalized, here's polyphenol, to now here's polyphenols that we're actually producing or putting that together specifically for that purpose. Looking from an antioxidant perspective specifically. I mean, there's other indications potentially with gut health, inflammation, and that sort of thing that they talk about. You know, when I say talk about, the companies come to me and like they probably do you, and they go to a lot of other people and talk about their products and what they have. But that's really something they're really looking at more aggressively, I would say, here in the past year or two.
So are there particular polyphenols that you're finding are more effective or that are really intriguing?
You know, I don't know if it's specifically from a specific polyphenol, but I mean, it's stuff that's coming from grapes, that sort of thing. We've done some studies here recently with a few of those directly. You know, different products are, you know, coming through at different times. I don't typically talk about product names 100%, you know, just kind of categorically what it is. But from a polyphenol perspective, I think it's important that you're really close to your supplier from that standpoint. We can talk about that a little bit later as well, from, you know, how to look at that or how I think we should look at that.
So the approach for antioxidant protection, is that primarily in the bird, or does that apply in the feed as well?
Great question. I mean, what we've been looking at here lately is in the bird. It's from the bird side of things. You know, obviously in the past, in years past, it's been in the feed as well. Right now, they're looking more directly in the bird itself, you know, and how does that work? You know, so we've you know, recently conducted a study where we're looking at basically vitamin E. You know, so we had a diet without vitamin E in it, any vitamin E supplementation. We had a diet that was higher than the NRC requirement, basically what some of the industry levels are using, you know, that 25 to 20 IU level. You know, NRC's 10 IUs, I guess, from a kilogram, about 4 or 5.5 IUs per pound. So I'm talking from a pound perspective. You know, so it was over, you know, 3 to 4 times the levels what we're using in a standard diet. We had no additional. And then what we were doing is taking that vitamin E supplementation that we had in the control, and we were cutting the vitamin E in half and then replacing that with a polyphenol product. And in doing so, you know, there's different ways of looking at it too, right? I mean, are you going to get an improvement in performance, or are you looking just to not drop in performance? You know, because that comes back to the cost versus the performance side of thing, you know, so it depends a lot on, you know, some of your vitamin costs as they fluctuate, as we know, you know, so really in a situation like that, if you're getting no difference in performance, you know, was the goal of this project. And we didn't see a difference in performance with the control that had the higher level of vitamin E. And full transparency, lower levels of vitamin E didn't really drop performance either. I mean, there was some residual in the diet, but there is some potential, I think, for that polyphenol level to help replace some of that. But the other thing is, you know, we really need to look at other parameters as well, metabolic parameters, you know, such as, you know, your superoxide dismutase, you know, circulating levels in blood like we've always done, looking at drip loss and processing, those sorts of things would indicate that there's something going on from an oxidative stress standpoint that it might be helping with. And in this study too, we did take blood twice. It was a 42-day study. We took blood at 21 days and at 42 days, looking at plasma vitamin E levels, and they were actually what you would expect. You know, so they were statistically different with no supplementation is the lowest, the supplementation is the highest, and then with the 50-50 blend was in the middle. So they were all three statistically different. So we were seeing differences in vitamin E status within the bird from that standpoint. So that was interesting to see. I mean, I think there's a lot of things from a future standpoint we can look at to dig into that a little deeper.
Are you looking for effective cleaning and disinfection solutions for your farm or hatchery? Look no further than Sidlines, an Ecolab company. Our AV Prime program offers advanced hygiene solutions that ensure thorough cleaning and disinfection of facilities and drinking water solutions with products like Kinosan, Virucid, and our newest addition, Sid 15X. You can reduce pathogens, improve animal health, and boost productivity. Trust Sidlines, an Ecolab company, for cleaner, healthier, and more effective poultry production.
If you're enjoying this episode of the Poultry Podcast Show presented by Wisenetics, please remember to like, subscribe, and share it with your friends and family. You can also set the notifications to on from our channel so you don't miss any other upcoming episodes. As always, please feel free to leave us your comments at any time because your feedback is always important to us. Dan, when someone's interested in using polyphenols and evaluating for their own use different products that are available, what criteria should people use in making those decisions?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And it goes back to kind of a decision tree process, thinking, you know, you need to look and see what their research is and look at the quality of their research. I mean, that's a key factor in this. You know, are they doing the research? Are they doing the research correctly? And what does that look like? There's a lot of good researchers out there. So, I mean, just make sure they're getting from a credible source. What are they doing to produce the polyphenols? Like, how are they doing that? What are their standardization processes? That sort of thing. So, I mean, those are two critical pieces of it that I would look at. Also when integrators looking at it, they need to see how it looks in their own system, right? I mean, that's always something that we encourage people to do. I mean, there's levels of research all the way up from a field standpoint. So you need to make sure that it fits into your system, how the economics looks for you. You know, if you're, and the other things, the kind of combination, the replacement side of things, you know, so look at it from that perspective versus, polyphenols are going to change everything. We only just need to feed polyphenols, or we only need to feed just one feed additive. It's a matter of looking at, the bigger picture. But from a supplier standpoint, I mean, I always encourage people to get to know their supplier, know where the product's coming from, really understand how to use it. I mean, that's what they're there for from a technical standpoint, is to really make recommendations on how to use the products. And then really look at the research and see what the research has told them and what kind of research they're doing, and be involved, obviously. I mean, it gets, you know it as well as I do, when everyone's discussing different things, it's a better outcome than just, you know, a straight sales call or trying to push it. So if you're an integrator or someone looking to use these products, I wouldn't say just say no right out of the gate. Just have the discussion and see how it might fit in your facility and your production system.
So polyphenols, we talk about polyphenols as if they're this one thing, but there's huge variation, of course, across the spectrum of polyphenols. So how do producers make evaluations? Because you can't necessarily just say this percent of polyphenol versus that percent, you should expect the same outcome.
Yeah, there's thousands of different compounds, obviously, that fall under the big bucket of polyphenols. I wouldn't say I'm a polyphenol expert, but I mean, it's a large category, obviously. And so I think that's, once again, where you need to really work with your supplier and see what they're trying to provide, what research they have from that perspective, and what they have in their product, you know, because a lot of them don't really get a lot deeper than just say we have, you know, percentage polyphenols, for example. So you got to look at where they're getting it, how their production system is, and then what their recommendation is. You know, so are they looking at this from a completely antioxidant standpoint? So you're looking at it from a replacement point of view, either in conjunction or in combination with something, or are you trying to do something a little bit different where you're saying, okay, we're looking at an inflammatory process, and what are they really gearing their specific polyphenol blend or combination towards? So, I mean, it's really, from that perspective, it's the goals of the end user and the product that they're bringing forward.
I'm curious about the impacts on carcass traits. You talked a little bit about that before, but maybe you can expand.
Yeah, I mean, so we talked a little bit about drip loss. You can look at coloring, that sort of thing. So anything that oxidative stress will impact is something to look at. You know, so if there's increased water holding capacity from the product, you know, stuff we've been doing for quite some time. So there's definitely carcass traits and carcass characteristics that needs to come to you with the research on polyphenols, because if it's having that impact that they're suggesting on oxidative stress, it should show up in the carcass traits as well. So, You can either look at the coloring. You can look at pHs of the breasts. I would look at breast quality. So if you're looking at any myopathies, or if you're looking at wooden breast, or if you're looking at spaghetti breast or striations, I would definitely ask for that kind of data to be looked at to see, you know, are we seeing differences there? Are we not seeing differences there? Looking at drip loss, you know, like I said, water holding capacity, I would definitely ask for that type of data. So carcass data should be a very big part of that decision-making process.
Again, you talked a little bit about using polyphenols in combination with other feed ingredients, antioxidant feed ingredients, and you mentioned vitamin E specifically. What about trace minerals? So obviously trace minerals are involved in the enzymatic antioxidant protection. Is there a relationship there as well?
You know, that's something we haven't tested yet, but I think that's a very logical place to go. You know, when you talk about selenium or some other minerals that have their cofactors and some of the enzyme pathways, my feeling is polyphenols probably will not replace that, right? I mean, so you need to have a certain amount of vitamin E, you need to have a certain amount of selenium or other minerals as well, just as cofactors or how some of their other functions are. So, you know, it's definitely a combination standpoint. Where would polyphenols fit from usage? I'm not anybody recommend to me, you know, and I haven't tested it yet either, you know, 100% replacement, you know, that obviously doesn't make sense. There's requirements out there for these things and there's different reasons for utilizing that. So we haven't looked at it from a mineral perspective, but it makes a lot of sense to do that. Can you replace it at some level? And, you know, and it's also something I think that is of interest, you know, as you know, we're embarking in a new era, you know, our NRC is several years old now. There are other references out there that you can utilize. But, you know, as we're moving forward, looking at requirements or guidelines for utilizing minerals and vitamins, it would be interesting to also look at, you know, how's that look in the face of usage with polyphenols. I think when we're looking at these things, there's more combinations we can look at now, which makes things more complicated, but there's more combinations we could look at now than we were looking at 30 or 40 years ago. So I think it is definitely something that's a value of looking at as we move forward from a research perspective.
As a poultry nutritionist and looking at trends in the industry, you know, we see birds growing faster and faster, being more and more feed efficient, higher breast meat yield, and increasing and changing disease challenges. So in these challenge or stress situations, do you think there's a change in the way or new opportunities in the way that we can use polyphenols?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, I think so. Polyphenols and other products as well. I mean, so we're changing the nutrition of the bird as we're changing the genetics of the bird. They're growing faster. Their stress is a much bigger issue potentially. So something like a polyphenol would be, I would think, of high interest as we move forward with these new genetics, the higher growing, higher, you know, faster birds, more efficient birds, like we just talked about, meat quality of those birds. I think it's got a very nice place in that system moving forward. You know, and you bring that up from that perspective, from a research perspective, do we look at things from a disease challenge? You know, there's new diseases cropping up all the time, as you've seen, whether it's bacterial or viral or something like that, or just from a management perspective, these birds, because they're changing so quickly. As you know, I mean, we have we know what strain of bird we're dealing with just by how they start responding at different ages. You know what you're probably going to see. 42 days, some strains look great. By the time they hit 56, they've fallen apart. You know, and they weren't designed for that. I mean, they're designed for different things. So that's what you would expect. So, you know, is it something you can utilize instead of a bird falling apart at day 42? Is it something you can extend them to day 49? You can decrease variation. You can decrease some issues. You know, an issue we have up here potentially, and we manage for it, is ascites. You know, we're at a higher elevation. So obviously ascites can be a bigger deal up here. You know, is it something you look at from that standpoint? I mean, there's always been discussion about oxidative stress being a part of that syndrome. You know, is it something we do here? So like I said, we manage it here so that we try not to have the levels, higher levels, just normal type levels. But is it something that we try here where, okay, we don't manage for it. We really push the birds extremely hard. When you push the birds hard in this environment, you will get ascites. Is it something that you can test on that environment? And obviously it's not that way everywhere, but we give you an indication. Okay, are we helping with oxidative stress at some level? If we're keeping ascites at a lower level than just letting it run. And then that really changes how you can manage birds. It changes how you can grow birds. You know, there's limitations. We can push them extremely hard. But when you do that, you're going to have some metabolic disorders show up. You're going to have structural issues show up. You're going to have meat quality issues show up. And a lot of that's related to oxidative stress at some level. It's not all, but some of it is. And so is that something, as we push them, can we use these polyphenol products to help mitigate some of that? You know, I think that's something of extreme interest that I think we should look at moving forward.
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir here in terms of the genetic advances, and the geneticists have done an amazing job. But
exactly.
It exposes new challenges and new physiological limitations that, you know, hopefully to a certain extent we can address with nutrition. So,
and I think we can. I mean, I think there's that ability to do that.
Yeah, it's we've got challenges, but I think it's looking positive for the industry in the future.
Yeah, definitely. But to me, that makes it exciting as well. You know, what can we look at from a new perspective? How can we utilize these products? How can you utilize them in combination? You know, and that's something with the phyto products I've seen a lot too. And their thinking is, you know, like I said before, it was kind of, we just want to use all the phyto product. We want to use all feed additive product and replace something else, the silver bullet, if you will. That mindset has changed. You know, they're really looking at it in combination with different products. How do we work on top of, you know, they don't want to go in and necessarily change an integrator's program, but like, how can we work with the integrator's program and what they're currently using? So I think that's a huge, huge area that's exciting, and a different way of looking at some of these products.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boehringer Ingelheim, health experts bring industry-leading knowledge and expertise to today's poultry producers to help them solve challenging health issues through smart, science-driven decision-making using the best resources available. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge. Adiseo provides nutritional solutions and services to help producers achieve their targets in a high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. Making life easier for animals and those who care for them is Jeffo's engagement. Strong bird performance starts with a healthy environment. Healthy environments start with Jones Hamilton. A worldwide leader in animal nutrition, Adiseo's portfolio of products includes methionine, the full range of vitamins, enzymes, organic selenium, probiotics, mycotoxin management strategies, and palatability products. With such a diverse offering, Adiseo supports its customers with a broad range of expertise, tools, and services to help them maintain a competitive advantage. Adiseo, fueling predictable profits. To learn more, visit Adiseo at www.adiseo.com.
Well, thanks a lot, Dan, for bringing your perspectives today.
Yeah, thank you.
Before we finish up, I've got a few closer questions for you. What's your favorite poultry or agriculture-related resource or book? What's your go-to?
Yeah, so there's a couple different things. I'm still old school, I guess. You don't want to admit you're still getting old. So I still look at the NRC quite a bit just for some basic information. The other thing I really utilize a lot, I mean, of course, now with social media and electronics and whatnot, it's not the same. I still like hard, you know, something I can tangibly get my hands on. But I really like meeting proceedings quite a little bit. I use that quite a bit as a resource. What have other people been looking at? What have other people been doing? I think it helps see where the future of things are going, and we're not just repeating things over and over and over again. And it gives me perspective when a client comes in, hey, maybe we ought to try this or look at this a little bit differently.
What about outside of agriculture? Do you have a book or resource that is your go-to?
I hate to tell myself a little bit too much, but I like podcasts quite a bit. You know, so there's if people know me, they know I like to hunt and be outdoors quite a bit. So I listen to the Meat Eater podcast quite a bit. It's an interesting one for me because it's not just about hunting. It's about history. It's about history of the outdoors. It's about history of Native peoples and how they interacted with the environment, how they interacted with animals. So I like to listen to that quite a bit. It gives me perspective. Sometimes I get worked up because they'll start talking about agriculture. They don't really know it that well. But for the most part, it's interesting.
That sounds like an interesting podcast. Yeah. The final question. In your experience, what do you think is the most important characteristic that a person has in order to be successful in the poultry industry?
You know, I think it's just in a general sense. With this day and age, with all the technology that we have, social media, which my kids are much better at using social media than I am, it's really being responsive. I think that's key anymore. You know, a lot of people really want a response quickly. You know, we're not in the days of memos, sending it through snail mail anymore. I mean, you can respond by email, you can respond by phone, you can respond by text, you can respond by social media. So I think it's really being responsive and reactive to people. It's still a people industry. So I think that that's is a key to success, is really being open to listening to people and being responsive to people, make sure they're being heard.
Well, Dr. Dan Moore, thanks so much for joining us today on the Poultry Podcast Show.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
That concludes another episode of the Poultry Podcast Show presented by Wisenetics. Thanks for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to stay updated on future episodes. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a review. Your feedback is important to us. You can visit our website at wisenetics.com and learn more about all our podcast segments for poultry, swine, dairy, beef, feed mill, crops, and even pet food. I'm Doug Korver, and I'll see you next time on the Poultry Podcast Show.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.